Indicted is a term meaning accused or to be brought to trial. In her book, The Indicted South, Public Criticism, Southern Inferiority, and the Politics of Whiteness, Angie Maxwell focuses on the impact that public criticism has had on white Southern identity over time, with repercussions still existing today. She argues that the explosion of mass media in the 1920s, much of which was targeted toward the South, shaped the way Southerners became defensive. She looks at three events in Southern history where the national criticism got really exacerbated. Maxwell recently stopped by the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss her new book with Ozarks at Large's Christina Karnatz. Christina began by asking about one of these events, the 1925 Scopes trial,
which sees more media coverage than probably any trial in all of American history, including being covered on the front page of international papers, telegraph wire being laid to Hong Kong for the first time, just a complete media firestorm. And some of the coverage by, you know, wonderful writers like H.L. Mencken wasn't even of the community that was dealing with the trial. It actually was an outside community, and it gets kind of conflated, and it really gets... You know, The Nation, for example, called the trial Tennessee versus Civilization. And the New York Times said, you know, called the people in Dayton, Tennessee during that trial cranks and freaks on their front page. So even though there is a truth, or there was an ignorance that surrounded some of those people that were involved with the Scopes trial, or lack of education, the use of certain words and terminologies really created a defensiveness in the South that is still kind of causing problems today.
Wasn't it sort of not designed necessarily, but to draw media attention?
It totally was, but not to draw media attention the way they thought.
Just to the evolution issue.
Well, it was because they, you know, certain different companies had closed down in Dayton, Tennessee. Their population had dropped pretty dramatically, and a lot of people were suffering financially. And so when the ACLU took out an ad saying that they would, you know, would they want to see a trial, one or two local people in Dayton, one of them, George Rapelier, who wasn't from the South, who was a northern investor, thought it would be a good chance to, like, fill the hotels and, you know, fill the restaurants, and just had no idea, you know, what it would become. When William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow decide to come represent each side, it took it to a level that they never expected or anticipated. I mean, they laid new, you know, train tracks because of the sheer volume of people that wanted to go there. And they didn't know, because they couldn't have predicted what was going to happen at the trial and the way William Jennings Bryan was going to falter on the stand in his interpretation of the Bible, and that he would die a few days after the trial and then become a martyr and make the story even bigger, right? They had no idea the light in which they would have been cast and that the impact that it would have over time. So in the book, I look at these different moments when public criticism of the South was extremely intense, even when it was well-deserved, and what happens to those communities after that criticism, and trying to understand how all of that feeds how we understand Southern white behavior.
And you mentioned how there are repercussions even today of that. Just with this latest legislative session in Arkansas, we gained a lot, and I say we because we live in Arkansas and in the South. There was a lot of national attention for things that I personally think were negative. I mean, you know, gun rights issues and the 12-week abortion and things like that. I mean, I did. I got defensive.
Sure. Well, Southerners tend to... that us versus them mentality works in the South. It's an old psychological pattern, and politicians can use it for good and for bad, you know, depending on which way you look at certain issues. But there is kind of a chip, you know, on the Southern shoulder, so to speak, for that kind of national criticism. And like I said, some of it has been very well deserved, particularly some of the other cases I look at in terms of resistance to integration and so on. But being kind of cast as the, you know, the other in the American kind of story, or the exception, or the aberrant, you know, part of the country, has created those patterns of defensiveness. And I look specifically at the way in which it kind of creates a cultural kind of inferiority complex. And what you said about, you know, yourself feeling defensive, that's fine. You can feel defensive and you can manage those feelings of defensiveness. But there are groups and individuals who that really becomes so overwhelming that we see kind of a complex kind of arise. And that's when we see very irrational behavior, like I think some of the behavior you see in massive resistance to integration, when we know integration is coming, the shutting down of schools, right? Those kinds of the denial of certain parts of history, right? It becomes really exacerbated. And usually that happens, and psychologists have found this, among communities that, you know, where there's a lack of education, there's poverty, and oftentimes kind of authoritarian religion. And when we see that a lot in the South, so that there's not a way to process that criticism. There's not a way to say, but we have all these great things, and it just becomes kind of a self-fulfilling mm-hmm. prophecy of sort.
Well, that's the way I feel. Yeah, but they're only highlighting all these negative things, and there's so many good
things.
Because
you're part of a community that has mm-hmm. a lot to feel proud of, and mm-hmm. you can disassociate from this criticism and, oh, they're really not getting it, or they really exaggerated that, and here's all these great things. But for some communities, it becomes so consciousness raising that they can't really process it, and there's not other good things happening. And when there's not other good things happening, it can create kind of a backlash. And that's why I think we see, you know, Southern whiteness, you know, in its infancy or as it's being developed, that constructed, it's about race. Sure, it's about white versus black. That's how it starts in the South. You know, defining whiteness becomes that. But as it goes along, it becomes opposed to a whole bunch of other things, like the federal government and science and expertise and, you know, all of these other things. And that's why it's kind of, I think, kind of like this intricate web now. And it can be set off or, you know, raised up if you trigger any of it, you know. And so very unusual things that we don't think are going to get people all up in arms, like climate change, becomes, you know, where Southern whites overwhelmingly deny it, its existence. And we think, how did that happen? And if you really understand how Southern whiteness has been constructed, it makes perfect sense. Yeah, so that's what the book's trying to kind of at a deeper level kind of unravel.
How, I mean, is there a way to change that mentality?
I think so. I mean, like I said, the original psychologist who coins the term inferiority complex was a man named Alfred Adler. And he was a contemporary of Freud. But Adler is the one that said, there's a couple of things you have to see this inferiority complex and the repercussions of it manifest in an individual. And I'm kind of loosely talking about it for a culture. You have to have a moment of consciousness. You have to have something come in to say you are less than. And then you have to be unable to deal with that. And like I said, education and authoritarian religion and poverty are the three things. So when we say education is the great equalizer, when we say education is the great uplifting, you know, thing that we should put all of our time and energy to, it's really true, because we do not see this happening as much when the education levels are higher in certain communities. We see that people understand complexity of public policy. They understand that just because it doesn't affect them, it's hurting somebody else. They tend to not react, you know, as in a reactionary way, as dramatically as when we see that not happening. Also, when people are suffering financially, we know that there's increased violence and increased, you know, resistance to change and all of these kind of issues. We have to work on those things, and we have to try. You know, in Arkansas specifically, you know, we can. And the reason all of this whole story to me, this whole book, the reason why it still matters is because politicians have been very manipulative with it, to the point where we've got, you know, poor white Southerners in many cases voting against their economic self-interest because the us versus them is constantly being played. But it can be played in another way. It can say, look at us, Arkansas. We expanded Medicaid. Look at us, Arkansas. We may have had a legislation that said that, you know, schools can, you know, choose to arm their you know, teachers and staff, but every single school in the state opted out. Look at us, Arkansas. You can say there's an us, or we are not that. We are this. You know, come be on the side of progress and common sense and taking care of the least among us and all of those kind. We can champion that. We are not them. You know, we always say, like, we're not Mississippi, right? And people kind of smile about that, mm-hmm. and kind of laugh about that, but that's powerful. And it can be utilized by politicians on either side that have a progressive agenda to say Arkansas is better than all of those things, I think. And that resonates with people because that pattern is very old and well-established.
Well, you also look at literature.
I do.
It isn't just civil rights and politics and mm-hmm. and the media. It's also, you know, the South's place in literature and the way that people have written about it in fiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the case studies that I look at is the group of Southern writers that, you know, first called themselves the Fugitives. Then some of them kind of transformed into a group called the Agrarians, and then others still from that group became the New Critics. And I wanted to also look at people who had opportunity and had means and still kind of felt victim to this criticism, in a sense, and this group, and that the criticism transformed them, that it has that kind of power, is what I wanted to show in this pattern. And this group of writers, you know, they say this in their papers and in their letters back and forth to each other, you know, they become so disillusioned by the criticism that comes out of the Scopes trial initially that they become very politically involved. And they write the very famous 1930 collection, I'll Take My Stand, in which they defend Southern agrarianism. And that book is pretty much universally panned by critics when it comes out. And it doesn't get them, so much so they're kind of shocked. And really among the elite literary, you know, circles that they aspired to belong to. And so we see slowly over the course of a few years, this same group pull away completely from politics and engagement and start a school of literary criticism called the New Criticism. And I'm not saying it's the only reason they delve into New Criticism, but at its core, New Criticism, very simplified here, says we don't have to know all the biographical information about an author. We don't have to worry about all that context. It's the verbal icon. It's the word on the page. You know, it's the art. And that's very convenient if you're being panned by critics and you want to somehow kind of shed your Southern skin. And these guys do exactly that. And so there's a metamorphosis that comes as a way of processing this criticism. And then they decide, okay, we're now going to be the judge of what is literature and what is not. They put themselves in kind of that position. And when Alfred Adler sketched out the inferiority complex, he said that there's really kind of three compensations that people will make when suffering from this. The first is that they will seclude themselves. They will go into isolation. They will literally withdraw from the society that deems them less than. Or they will criticize somebody else as being inferior to make themselves feel superior. Or they will change the rules by which you're being judged. And in each of these cases I look at, we see a culture, a community, a whole group of people kind of perform those compensations. Now it's messy to take an individual diagnosis and apply to a culture, and you really can't, but you can sketch out the pattern. And in an effort to say this criticism has affected Southern whites dramatically and is at the root of a lot of these kind of key moments in Southern history.
You study the South, mm-hmm. yet the entire United States as a whole has a rich history and stuff. So why devote yourself to just one region?
It's a great question. I mean, you can't really understand the South unless you look at it within the nation at large. And that's been kind of a debate within Southern studies, which is, you know, do you kind of close yourself off and say, I look within the borders, or do you look at the relationship between the region and what it says about the country at large? And for me, the dynamics between the two have to be understood in all of their complexity. But the reason the political culture, which I think at its core is kind of what this book leads to, is so interesting to me is because prior to really like the 1940s, anytime somebody wrote a big analysis of American politics, there was usually kind of like a little asterisk that would say, or a footnote somewhere that would say, this applies to the country minus the 11 states of the former Confederacy. Because things just, political behaviors and institutions just didn't function down here like they did everywhere else. Until a man named V.O. Key got a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to go down and do a big analysis of what is going on down the South. And that book, Southern Politics and State and Nation, really launches the field of Southern politics. And he's trying to understand why it has behaved differently. Now, he does, you know, maps and quantitative analysis and voting rights, all these kind of things, and that's fine. But underneath it really is a distinct culture, a distinct agriculture, climate, you know, history, religious affiliation, all of it, that creates this subculture within the country at large. And yet, when you look at presidential elections over the 20th century, it has been extremely influential as a voting block for the Democrats for a long time and now for the Republicans. And so it casts this great influence. It seems to lag behind the rest of the country on a lot of very important issues, and we have to understand why. And it's where all the immigration is coming in, which is also means we're going to see diversification at rapid levels. So it is kind of a laboratory, the South, in a weird way. And I think through studying it, not only do you learn about this region from, you know, where I grew up, but it explains a lot about America, too.
I wish we could break away from it.
You know, it's coming. Yeah. It's coming.
All right.
You know, Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012 is the first Democrat in the modern era to win without having to win a single Southern state. Now, he wins some Southern states, but he didn't have to. And that is a big difference. You know, that is a different that's a different animal altogether. In some ways, it makes the Republican Party very dependent on the South, but it doesn't make both parties dependent on the South, which was the way it was for a long time. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
All right. Thanks, Angie.
No problem.
Angie Maxwell is the Diane D. Blair Professor of Southern Studies and Assistant Professor of Political Science in the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences. She is also the author of The Indicted South: Public Criticism, Southern Inferiority, and the Politics of Whiteness, New Directions in Southern Studies. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Karnatz.